This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? I would appreciate it greatly. In fact, also go to the website, particularly this week, because not only will you find information on the survey that we mention in this week's episode, but you can also get tickets to my new show, The Confidence Artist, which is at the Melbourne Magic Festival from the 4th of July. I say new show, it's basically a best of. So all of my favorite scams and cons from all my previous shows put together into one crash course in con artistry. So you'll learn how to cheat at cards, how to tell a really good lie, how to talk someone out of their wallet, and I'm planning a big finale, which will be brand new and never seen before. So that's The Confidence Artist at the Melbourne Magic Festival from the 4th of July. Anyway, Scammapaloozas, on with the show. Have you ever wondered why your Facebook feed is filled with quizzes and tests designed to measure everything from your intelligence to your emotional stability to which character from Friends you're most like? Personally, I think we do it because there is a human need to measure ourselves and to get an empirical idea of who we are. So why is it that we don't have a reliable measure of gullibility? On this week's episode, Alice Tennessa, a PhD student at Macquarie University's Department of Psychology, discusses her work exploring gullibility and whether it is possible to tell just how big of a sucker someone really is. I'm skeptical, but I'm a classic Chandler, and we always think that way. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. First became interested in gullibility because of Stephen Greenspan, who we had as a guest on Scammapalooza. How did that come about? What drew you to his work?
It sort of came to me towards the end of my undergraduate when I had to start picking a topic to research for my postgraduate, like honours thesis and beyond, and obviously leading into PhD. And just some things sort of coming together. I was just curious on why people started falling for scams, or why some people seem to always fall victim to the bad guy. Is that person you have in your mind as that ultimate victim, always gets taken in by the bad guy, always is taken by scams? And I thought I want to look a little bit more into this. And so I, of course, went to places like Google Scholar and the psychology journals and started typing in all the keywords I could think of that were relevant to this idea. And of course, one of the main key terms was gullibility. And to my surprise, there was actually very little strong empirical evidence on this topic. And so I decided to leave the journals a bit and just did some general Googling, which is not always the best way to go about things. But doing this, especially looking up books, I ended up finding Stephen Greenspan's book, The Annals of Gullibility. And I thought, finally, someone from a psychological background is actually writing about this topic. And so, of course, I bought the book and read it and found it really, really interesting to follow up and read into. His perspective is an interesting one.
And is that why your master's, so your master's or honours thesis, where you really decided just to review the existing work on the topic to really say what's out there and what can you read?
Yes. Basically, in my master's thesis, I did two things. The first half was really looking at a current lay of the land in the psychological literature. So what have people looked at, or what's related but not exactly gullibility? And so I did a big sort of literature review, some of which talked a little bit about Greenspan's work, but lots of other topics that are related, things like scam compliance is one of them, but things like research into trust or motivation or persuasion and that type of thing. And the second half of my thesis, more looking at developing a measure of gullibility, so looking at some kind of self-report scale, and that was the second half.
So do you think that you can measure gullibility? Is it something that you think, in 25 words or less, go. This is always the thing, I guess, that you have in psychology is you're trying to measure things which are difficult to measure. Do you think there could be a gullibility quotient? Do you think there's like an IQ for gullibility and there's a number that we can get for ourselves?
I think that's a really interesting question. And that's something I'm definitely going to explore. But no, I actually do think that there are some people who might have a, like you said, a quotient, like call it a gullibility quotient, a GQ, if you will. Yeah. Maybe some people have some scores and others. But just like with things like intelligence, I think certain situations can then also affect that score. So say you put two people in an identical situation and one person say high on gullibility and one is low, and you put a certain situation in front of them, and maybe the person who is high in gullibility only needs a little bit to tip them over into doing something silly or something that's going to hurt themselves, whereas the person who's lower might need a more desperate situation or a more intense situation to get them up to that line. So I feel in some situations, all of us could be gullible, and in some situations, only those with a higher, I guess, GQ, as you've now called it, would tip over into doing something that's hurting themselves.
I would imagine also that for, you know, someone who may have a, you know, a high GQ, as we're calling it, may find themselves in, I love this. What I love is if this becomes a thing, if GQ now, like that's what it's called, and it's, you write
it. In this case, high GQ is bad.
High GQ is bad. Great. We've started good. Okay. Yes. So let's say I've got a high GQ, but I might be in a situation where I am, you know, I'm never going to be deceived. I'm never going to be scammed. But situationally, that might actually just be a bad situation for someone else to be in. Like, is that idea that it's not just an internal thing, but a personal and situational thing? That
yes, definitely. This is something I'm starting to look at now in my PhD research. Is I'm looking at situations that could make someone gullible where they're normally not, and I'm really interested in looking at sort of basic psychological needs. So this is something that Kip Williams, psychologist, sort of talked a lot about, that we have four basic psychological needs. Like, we have a need to belong, a need for self-esteem, a need for control, and a need for meaningful existence. And for example, when one of those needs are thwarted, like the need to belong, if you've been excluded or ostracized, a lot of research has been done onto this, and people can do very self-harming things almost just to get back into the group, because humans are social creatures.
And that would be a situation where someone, I mean, this is obviously the cliche of the person who falls for the lonely heart scam because they are lonely and want that sort of connection. Would that be the sort of example you're talking about?
Exactly. I mean, some of the research that's already been done has found people who've been ostracized or socially excluded are much more likely to make risky financial decisions, or leads to more superstitious thinking, or they're more easily persuaded or more susceptible to social influence if you've been ostracized. So, of course, that would then mean that if you are feeling very, very lonely and suddenly you're on a relationship, you know, eHarmony style kind of RSVP, whatever, website, and a profile comes up and suddenly someone tells you you're amazing and wonderful, you're the love of my life, and in 2 weeks, let's get married, you might be a bit more likely to fall for that, because normally you're quite a discerning, critical person, but you just happen to be lonely, and now you're lonely, you make yourself vulnerable.
Does it, I mean, when I think of lonely, I think of, you know, sitting at home, pining after lost love, you know, staring off into the dark. Can that loneliness sort of manifest itself in different ways? Because you talked about being, I guess, not a part of a group. So you could have a situation where somebody, for example, I don't know, like they leave their church or their school or their work or something like that, and they're not necessarily miserable or lonely, but they're disconnected. Would that also apply? Would that also be something that could make someone more gullible? Or do you think...
I think so. I mean, it's very general because, again, there's not much research, and this topic, the more I look into it, the bigger it becomes. But it's easier sometimes to limit it to romantic loneliness because it's something that is quite easy to study. But I do think it might generalize that if you suddenly become disconnected from your family group, from your culture or that kind of thing. So if you're feeling like you're alone and you're on the outer, I think it could make you more vulnerable.
Yeah, okay. When we have, I mean, and this is just obviously just one thing that you're looking at, and you looked at multiple factors. At what point do you, I mean, this is probably a question you're still trying to answer yourself. At what point do you stop? And this is probably something that happens in psychology a lot, is that at what point do you stop measuring factors? Because when you start looking at social compliance and superstition and, you know, group dynamics and all of these things, at what point do you sort of say enough, like, we need to sort of step back a little.
I can see it's like if you can start measuring 10 million variables, your statistical analysis will become impossible.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you have to use your theory and go, okay, theoretically, what are the most important variables here? What's going to make the most impact? Because if, for example, you're looking at some tiny variable like gender, I know it's not tiny, but sometimes there are gender differences in the way people behave. Or you might look at shoe size or hair color or something like that. Maybe it explains a small percent of the variance. That means people are more likely to do something with a certain hair color. But just because it's found to be an effect doesn't actually mean anything. And it doesn't make logical sense to include those kind of variables. So I guess when you start with research, you start with a really good theory and you measure the ones variables that you think are related to it and try and develop a nice parsimonious or sort of efficient model of this behavior. I mean, you could spend the rest of your life just picking random variables and hope they're related to, say, gullibility, but that's probably not the most efficient use of your time.
But what if we can get funding for that? Surely then it's worth doing.
If I can get funding, sure. I would love to spend the rest of my life running very similar experiments, testing different things.
Excellent. Good. Just before we leave your master's, which I enjoyed very much because you open with a joke, which I think is always good for a
master's. You've got to set the right theme for this kind of thing.
You do, yeah. A lot of people go for a jokey title, but you've gone for a little joke at the beginning, which I liked very much. One of the things you sort of come back to is detection. In that, and you talk about deception detection and lie detection and cheater deception, I think it was one of the other ones. From a practical point of view, and I realize in academia, like, you're not always looking for the practical application, but that sounded like a bit of a slight, didn't it?
How dare you?
You know, like, you're not necessarily thinking about, like, what is the, you know, how are we going to bottle this and sell it, but the idea of being able to detect gullibility or detect scams or potential to be, you know, taken advantage of. I mean, you mentioned that idea a lot, but is that something that, you know, like with our GQ, that there are so many factors, you know, like obviously we talk about lie detectors is that holy grail, and there are no real lie detectors that work. Is it the same with things like gullibility and scam detectors, that there's just not, you know, we're just going to be limited, or is it possible?
I think in a lot of that research, especially when you're looking specifically at scam compliance, you can get bogged down into trying to make those lie detectors, like you said. But I think I'm taking a step back and looking overall at gullibility, which is sort of part of your personality. And I guess if you're more aware that you might be more gullible, if I can demonstrate there are certain situations that a gullible person will be more vulnerable, maybe that's the way you can protect yourself. So if I find out empirically that social isolation and ostracism can increase gullibility a lot, maybe it's one of those things you can write down, though. Know that when you are feeling alone or isolated, you're more vulnerable. So be more careful at that point in time. Or if you know that for example, you get the classic Prince of Nigeria emails. You get those 419 emails telling you, oh, you've won the Spanish National Lottery, or you're going to inherit all my money, or that kind of thing. If you can tell people certain situations make you more vulnerable, make sure you're aware of this, or maybe even just in terms of skills, you know, apply that critical thinking. Know that when you receive emails from people you don't know, it's worth doing some checking. You know, is this a real bank that sent me this information? Is this a real prince? Does Nigeria even have a prince? You know, that kind of thing. Do a bit of, just maybe teaching, do a bit of extra Googling or asking around rather than just blindly kicking reply.
Because this is something that I come up against a lot, because I do a lot of scam education. So I'm sort of meant to be teaching people about scams. And I'm always asked, you know, what are the latest scams that we need to be wary of for newspaper and, you know, articles and things?
Yeah.
And I never know what to say because everyone knows the answers. You know, we all know that it's the Nigerian scam or the, you know, Lonely Hearts or whatever it is. It's never the new, you know, it's never the latest, greatest scam. Yeah. It's just the old scams, but with fancy wrappings. But it's that thing of what you're talking about, of trying to sort of show people the problem is not necessarily the scam. Mm. It's more about teaching people about themselves and how they think, which is
exactly.
which is a difficult thing to do, because thinking about how you think requires a level of introspection that I know I'm not prepared to do for myself.
But I guess it's something that's more of a movement in psychology in general now, is that mindfulness.
Yes.
And just being aware of who you are. So I guess maybe it's moving that more mindfulness into the specific situation. You know, you're a vulnerable person, or there are certain situations that make you more vulnerable, and just being more mindful about that might just even itself help save you from doing something that you will seriously regret later.
Can we, as well as our GQ trademark 2017, can we also work together and create a mindfulness gullibility coloring book that people can do?
Oh,
they can like they color in at the same time they're sort of learning about their social compliance.
And pictures of an email with the Prince of Nigeria.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Yes.
Man, this is, we're going to make so much money from this episode. This is going to be good.
This is going to be great.
We're going to do really well.
But something I thought I'd like to quickly mention here, because we talked a little bit about Greenspan's work.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that I've taken a bit of a divergence from his original ideas. Because when we come back to what gullibility is, it's where I sort of have a bit of a, I guess, conceptual divergence from him, because he really looked at gullibility. He defined it in contrast to credulity, because he argued that credulity was believing something when you really shouldn't, and gullibility is more as being vulnerable to being tricked or manipulated. Gullibility was really a behavior, something that you did, like you paid money or something that you really shouldn't have done, a behavior, something you can measure, whereas credulity is a belief. And I think that there is inherently a problem in that division. I mean, it seems very nice and neat. You can measure behaviors, you can measure beliefs, but there is a problem there, because if you objectively look at someone performing behavior that may not be in their self-interest, like when you're walking at one of those shopping centers and those people accost you trying to sell you stuff, which everyone knows often is overpriced or doesn't do what it's meant to do. It's a bit of a sort of slight scam, and a lot of us have fallen victim to it. Objectively, you look at someone and they buy the thing, you're like, behavior, they've paid money for something that's silly, that's gullible. But what if the person who was buying it knew it was a scam, essentially, but just paid that money to end the interaction? They just wanted to move on. Yeah, and so it's one of those things that I think you're looking at, when you're only looking at behavior, you're missing out on the motivation behind that behavior. And so when I define gullibility, I look at it more in terms of beliefs and behaviors. So I define it more as accepting a false premise or accepting something that is false when there are cues or untrustworthiness cues, something that's indicating that it's not true. So there's something that's sent to you, you're interacting with something that's doesn't seem legitimate, but you believe it anyway. And whether or not you act on that, it's not always as relevant, but the fact that you believe and you may or may not then behave is how I look at gullibility.
So it's almost a bit like the legal idea where they talk about a reasonable person. So would a reasonable person fall for this? And if you fall for it, and a reasonable person wouldn't, you are gullible. And if you don't for it, then you are either reasonable or okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
A woman I know said I was talking about. She went on a cruise and she was talking about all the things she did, and she mentioned. She goes, oh yes, we're in Auckland, and then of course we ran into the Israeli facial guys. I've forgotten the exact. Do you know the scam?
Are you like the Dead Sea Salt?
The Dead Sea Salt. That's the one. Like the Israeli Dead Sea Salt guys, which you know range from overpriced products to just flat out scams, depending on which company it is. And these guys were like scammers. They got run off, and a lot of them got arrested in Auckland. And she said, oh, and you know, God, it cost me $5,000 to get rid of those con artists. And so there was a sense of that she'd spent $5,000 on these products she didn't want, and she said to get rid of them. Now, I don't know if that's that classic thing that people do when they get scammed, of rather than admitting they were gullible, they come up with a story later on, which is I know what I would do, is to say, oh, no, I knew, but, you know, I was this summer.
I totally knew. I was just playing along.
I just wanted to see if anyone else was going to spot it. You know, that thing, or if it's exactly what you're saying, that people will avoid in order to avoid an uncomfortable situation, will, you know, put up with all sorts of, you know, terrible things. I think that's it. Stephen Greenspan does say in his book, when he talks about how to, how to be less gullible. One of the things he talks about is coming up with an exit strategy, like coming up with a way of removing yourself from the situation. So that's sort of the idea, like even, you know, so you're in a situation where you feel pressured to say yes, even if you know the answer is no. So hopefully he won't listen to this, but I think I prefer your idea better of combining both action and motivation.
I respect Greenspan's ideas, and he's one of the first to actually look into it, but he's coming from a different background because I think he's more of a developmental psychologist, and a lot of his research is sort of on case studies and started with people with developmental delays, whereas my background, I guess, is more in personality and social psychology, and I'm more interested in, I guess, the term would be neurotypicals, or just people who don't have developmental delays who are typical, and why are they falling for these scams? So I guess we're coming at it from different angles. So that could be why we have this slight, you know, academic disagreement about defining this term.
You're way too nice. You need to pick a fight with him. You need like a feud, across hemispheres feud between the two of you would be brilliant.
Yes, US versus Australia. That's the way to go about it.
Yes, I'll stoke the flames here. Do you think that, okay, there's a lot, something you see a lot on the internet and in comments forums in particular, is people very quick to point things out as, which is where I get all my academic information, by the way, is from YouTube comments.
Of course.
People are very quick to point things out as being scams or fake or hoaxes in an attempt to sort of show themselves as being not gullible. I'm trying to think of a good example. Oh, I posted a funny photograph on a website and was accused of faking the photograph for my own fame and glory. And it was surprising how many people and how vitriolic they were in pointing out that I was trying to deceive them with a funny photo that wasn't real. And there is a sense that when people do that, and it was a real photo, but there is a sense when people do that, that is fine to do. They're wrong, but it's still not a weakness, or, you know, they haven't made an error in that sense. Do you think you can have, I guess, this sort of reverse gullibility where you become so suspicious, you know, the idea of like when you think something is a scam or you think you are going to be deceived when there are no indicators that you are? Is there a flip side to it?
Yes, it's interesting you mention that. Firstly, the bit of advice is never read the comments, I'm told.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
let me write this down. Never read the comments.
Yeah, never read the comments. But I think there's a researcher called Baumeister who wrote a paper with some other colleagues on what he called sugrophobia. Now, sugrophobia is essentially fear of being a sucker. So you're constantly on guard about being taken in. So you'd rather reject everything and risk, you know, losing out than being taken in by one thing. But I think in that particular paper, he argues, and this is something that's in line with my thinking, is those people who are sugrophobic or, you know, extremely averse of being made a sucker of are the ones who are less likely to have more and more experience. They're probably more likely to be taken in. Because the people who are more open to experiences will have to sort of build up their social intelligence and work out what is a good situation, what's a bad situation, and develop those skills more. Whereas those people who shut down completely and everything and try to be, I guess, so risk averse by never engaging in anything, the one time they let their guard down is when they'll be taken in.
Yeah, I think I read the abstract. I was going to say read that paper, but that would have been a lie. I think I might have read the abstract on the... There was a similar one that talked about very intelligent people or well-educated people were also sort of likely to be scammed or likely to fall things because they hadn't, you know, learnt the hard way.
This is a different paper. This is Charlton. I think it's called the Clever Sillies Hypothesis.
Yes, that's the one.
It argues that people who are very, very clever use a different type of reasoning as opposed to, say, using common sense. I mean, something that Stephen Greenspan talks a lot about, common sense, and argues that often people who are gullible are lacking in common sense. And so Charlton's Clever Sillies Hypothesis, saying people who are very, very clever use a different type of reasoning, and as a result, often might get taken in because not using a common sense to evaluate something. And so they become very silly, even though they're very clever.
Yeah. It reminds me of the book, I think it's called The Gift of Fear which is a which is a he's not a scientist or a psychologist, I don't believe, but he's a security expert. And he talks about how people will, and he talks a lot about specifically women, will often put themselves into dangerous situations because they want to overcome their emotional response to the situation in an attempt to be more rational and more, you know, and more logical and more thoughtful. He talks about it in terms of women, I think, because most of the people that he worked with as a security consultant are women, and that, so that's the that's his target market, which is cynical.
Yeah.
But he talks, I mean, he talks, for example, about, you know, some, he talks about a woman who might, who went up to an elevator door, the door opened, there was a guy in there, she felt threatened by him, physically just threatened by him, didn't know why, but just did, and still got in the elevator anyway, because she felt like she needed to be rational and logical about the situation, which was there was no perceived threat. And he basically said that humans are the only species that would feel fear and then put themselves into an enclosed space with the thing that they feel fear of. I don't know how that stands up to academic rigor, but as an idea, like what you're talking about of this idea of like logically trying to kind of, you know, trying to apply logic to situations where you need to use common sense or maybe use your instincts. I'm not sure whether that applies.
You know, humans pride themselves on being rational and logical, but actually nearly all the research that we do in that particular area shows that we are not. We don't tend to make – we have to work very, very hard to be that way. And because our brains are designed to satisfy, not optimize. So I guess you could say our brains are lazy and use heuristics or mental shortcuts to make decisions, because if we had to think through every decision or everything that we do in our lives in a rigorous way, you'd never get anything done. So most of the time that system works in such a way to help us get through life in a reasonable and satisfying way. But every now and again, that system will fail in specific situations. So it was good enough for our ancestors in the past, but it's no longer as good as it could be for us today.
Do you think maybe we have just higher standards for ourselves today than perhaps they had? Like that, you know, in the old days, maybe it was okay to, you know, like, well, he got eaten by a saber-toothed tiger because he didn't react quick enough to that fear situation, but he's been eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, so let's get on with our day. Whereas now we sort of, you know, we're constantly, psychologically in particular, expecting more and more of ourselves. You know, we're kind of expected to be happier and more satisfied and less gullible and,
Do you think it is. It is. I mean, I think, you know, well, apart from the fact compared to our saber-tooth-eaten friend, our life expectancy is probably three times as long anyway. We're making ourselves live longer. And because we have more time to do things apart from just reproduce and die, I guess we're having distractions like podcasts and technology and space missions and stuff. But apart from that, we also have, you know, money and people who want to take our money. So it's hard for us, I guess, as humans to try and behave in the way that we need to in the modern world when our, I guess, our lizard brains or our old caveman brains want to do other things. You know, often we prefer to focus in the short term when the long term would be better off, or we focus on making decisions that will help us now or help just our group now rather than individually. This would help me best rather than everyone. And yeah, I think in terms of gullibility, I guess that might almost be a first world luxury in a way. Once you've satisfied all your other basic needs, like you've got a roof over your head, you've got enough food and you're fairly happy as a person. When the minute you start having slightly a bit of extra money to play with is when you're at risk of losing it, I guess. And people who are more desperate who don't have that money or don't have those needs met are going to work their best way to get yours, to get your money.
Yeah. So it's almost like on that sort of hierarchy of needs, like the kind of...
Yes, let's go to Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes, I did... It's a psychology up until year 12, and I've got some sociology as well, so I can pull out some buzzwords.
But we all know that's a famous, the famous pyramid, the hierarchy of needs, where the bottom level is basically like food and safety, and you move your way up until self-esteem, and so you get to self-actualization at the very top. Not that most people, I think most research said that almost no one actually self-actualizes. So let's just stick with the second top rung and be happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe part of the problem is that there are, you have all these people who've reached, you know, all but self-actualization, and then you have con artists who come out and say, I can get you to that top level, you know, where you have this, you have all of your other needs are met, and this is the last thing that you need to be perfect. And that's when they're going to, and it's also that thing that's almost impossible to reach. Like you said, psychologists kind of say, just ignore it.
So. Yeah. But it could also be, you know, if you are two or three levels down and you want to get up to the self-esteem level.
Yeah.
That you are willing, you have enough money, you have enough safety and security, but you're lonely or lacking in self-esteem, which is one of the basic human needs. You're willing to pay money to something, think you'll get you that self-esteem. So it could be a con artist there at every step trying to get us up to the next level, apparently, but actually take us down a level.
Oh, that's depressing.
I know. One step forward, two steps back.
I don't know about you. Do you often just get... You just get all excited about how all these things work, and then you have a sudden moment of, oh, wait, there are people being screwed over. This is a depressing thing to be talking about.
Yeah. I think I can't even remember. So I was going to do something the other day at the bank, and they said, oh, we can't give you this over the counter because of this. And I'm like, oh, I forgot that people are mean and lie and cheat and try to take other people's money. I just completely forgot that happened. I just thought you could take me at face value. And you make yourself sad, and then you go and, you know, try and do something to cheer yourself up that doesn't involve giving money to the Prince of Nigeria.
Yes, who has more than enough money in that he doesn't exist. So let's talk about your PhD. I realize you are right in the middle of it, so this is always a difficult thing to talk about. I'm thinking we could probably send, because you're doing a questionnaire for the...
I am.
If we talk about the questionnaire itself, is that going to mess? And then send people to do the questionnaire. Is that going to mess with your results?
No, I'm doing a bit more on this questionnaire. I'd love to talk about it, but not maybe as specifically, with specific items, but I can talk around it.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm trying to develop a self-report questionnaire, which is something I can then look at. It's almost like the GQ, if you will.
Yeah.
And then what I can do in experiments, put people in situations where they're feeling sad or lonely and see if it then changes their level with this measure. So it's almost like a thermometer, I guess, if you will. And I need to validate it, because just because me thinking up some items and writing them down doesn't necessarily mean it's gullibility. So, of course, I need different kinds of people to do this questionnaire. I mean, for example, the Australian Skeptic Society has been wonderful. They've advertised this study, and so many skeptics have got on board and done this. Within like a week, I've got so many responses. It's been amazing. But the one thing I do need is people who've been actually a victim to a scam to also fill it in, because I want to compare and see if people who are victims to scams get slightly different kinds of scores to, say, people who are skeptics or people who are first-year psychology students, for example. I've got a couple of different sort of populations who I want them to do this, I guess, questionnaire to see how the different scores fall depending on what group you're from.
Do you have a hypothesis about first-year psychology students? Because I think I have the mind of a first-year psychology student. Like, I know a little bit, and because of that, I'm just strutting around like I know everything. Like, I'm like, you know, dropping...
Well, you'd be surprised. Yeah. A lot of people have done a lot of research on first year psychology students and tried to compare it to the rest of the population. And although psychology students on average are younger, I guess, than a general population, because they're, you know, usually 18 to 20 years old or something, they tend to respond the way most community members would. So especially on this scale, when I was developing it, I used both a sample of first year students and just general community members. I put the study up on various discussion boards and Facebook and shared it all these different places. And basically, my community sample was a little bit older, but they scored very similarly to first-year students. So I was happy to say that this scale seems to, at a general level, look the same for these kind of populations. So now I'm a bit more interested in seeing, well, let's look at specific types of people, like someone who self-identifies as a skeptic or someone who says, yes, unfortunately, I have been victim to a scam. I'd like to compare those groups. So the funny thing is, the skeptics have been wonderful, not skeptical at all. They go straight in and do my scale straight away. Scam victims, people who have been victim to a scam, unfortunately, seem to be a lot less eager to do my scale. I haven't had as many participants, which is a shame. But hopefully someone out there who has unfortunately been victim to a scam, it doesn't necessarily mean have to be a big scam, just something where you were taken in and you wish you hadn't have been, if I can get people like that to do my scale, it'll be really helpful for me.
Okay. We'll try and get those people across. The thing that I did it myself, and it felt weird because of what I do, the questions were basically, I felt like were asking me, am I gullible? Would always feel like, yes I am. Because even when I think that I'm not, I know that I probably am more gullible than I, you know, I'm basically, I have a low opinion of myself. But the questions were asking me about what other people think of me. It would, you know, like, would people ever call you gullible? That kind of question. I would automatically, no one would ever call me. Like, people are always assuming that I'm not, you know, like, my website is conman.com.au. Like, oh no, Nick knows all that stuff. He'd never fall for anything. And whereas I feel the opposite. And I felt like it was either one end of the scale or the other. I felt like I was going to skew your results.
Yeah. Well, I really deliberately had different kinds of questions like that. I had some that questions that are like, do you think you are? And the other one's like, do your family think, or do your friends think? Because sometimes you're almost either too close to yourself, you don't really know, or you might second guess yourself, but you know that your family says this about you all the time, or your friends. So it's just another way of triangulating in on how you think, how you measure on this scale. So I guess maybe because you're a bit more mindful about your own personality, you think, yes, maybe I could be taken in, but because you're aware of it, you might be more vigilant when something comes across your path, and hence not be taken in.
The study that everyone seems to bring up at the moment is that, and it has come up a lot on this podcast, is people like to talk about Dunning-Kruger. It's a bit like mindfulness. You know, it's one of those things people like to bring out. Is that
ignorance is bliss?
Yes, yeah, that's right. Is that relevant? Can we shoehorn that in here? Is that something that, you know?
Well, we can. Well, it's an interesting study. It's something that I have got on my future Alessa will deal with this list.
Yeah.
But it's basically the Dunning-Kruger effect is where people who are amateurs at something assume that they're much better than people who are expert at something, even though the experts are always intrinsically better. I think the classic study was looking at joke telling, wasn't it? And looking at the funniness of jokes.
Yeah.
And I think the people who are amateurs, essentially, I guess probably first year psychology students, thought they were very, very funny and amazing, and their ability was way above normal, whereas the comedians didn't think they were very good at all. But it turns out, of course, that the people who are experts are better. And I think that might be relevant, and I think it's a really interesting point that you've raised, is that people who might be low on gullibility might actually feel that they're higher. So they're a bit more vigilant about that compared to people who are high on gullibility might be like, no, I'm amazing, I'm so skeptical, I'll never get taken in.
You should put that into your PhD. You should just shoehorn that in as like a side thing. You've got plenty of time, right? You've got lots.
I've got 2 years to go. It's
oh,
fine.
Easy, it's fine. Easy. Oh, yeah, no. As I understand it, PhDs are very easy and relaxing, and not that much hard work at all.
Oh, yeah, best years of your life. You do nothing and get money for it.
No. Sounds great.
I'm glad no one can see me because I'm crying right now.
Just alone in a room, sobbing. Oh, dear. Where's the best place? A link to the questionnaire up on social media for myself, which is just Honest Con Man on social media in general, and on the website at conman.com.au. Where else can people find it? Is there a direct link that they can go to?
That's a good question, because I don't actually have a website or anything. So I have been sharing it. I've been sort of going to social media pages where people, for example, are scam victims, and sharing in those places. Yeah, I think the best way to find it would probably be via your links rather than mine. I think I need to get a website at some point.
Yeah.
I have to do that.
And then what you can do is just in order to check.
Read the comments.
That's right. Just don't read the comments. What you need to do is have like your last question on this scalability thing needs to be like, what is your credit card number? And we just need to know for ID purposes. We're not going to charge any money. We just need to know. Yeah. What's your...
Please, $10 for a free receipt.
That's right.